The following program was pre-recorded, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station or its management.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Welcome to Education Nation, where we tackle the biggest issues in American education. School is now in session. Here are your hosts, Headmaster Rebecca Hagstrom and co-host Mark Durkin.
Hey, teacher, leave them kids alone.
Well, good evening, and thank you for joining us here on Education Nation. I am Headmaster and host Rebecca Hagstrom, and it's a privilege to join you every Saturday evening here on AM 1280 The Patriot. And of course, I'm joined in studio once again by the producer of Education Nation and my wonderful co-host, Mark Durkin.
Another wonderful Saturday to you, Rebecca.
Yes, we're getting closer to spring. We can hang in there a little longer.
Yes, just a few more weeks,
yep,
right?
Yep. Well, over the last decade, Mark, the state of Minnesota has seen a steady climb in the student achievement gap. And what's equally disturbing is this increase also comes as the state celebrated a graduation rate of 83.2% in 2018, which is up significantly.
Yes, it is.
We've covered this on our show many times before. The achievement gap problem hasn't stopped the state from setting an ambitious goal this year. Under the federal government's Every Student Succeeds Act, Minnesota has a goal of 90% of its students graduating in 4 years, which, by the way, I think it was sitting at about 50% just about 2 years ago. And no single student group's graduation rate will be below 85%.
We're talking large growths in just a very short period of time. And, you know, despite the inflated graduation rate numbers, a group of prominent leaders in Minnesota politics and business are using their public platforms to push a proposed constitutional amendment aimed at closing the ever-increasing student achievement gap and guarantee that all children the fundamental right to a quality public education. Is this really the right way to do this? Well, our guest tonight says virtually no state has produced enduring academic gains or narrowed the gap by turning education over to the courts. In fact, our guest says the proposed amendment on education will do nothing but cause new problems.
Mm-hmm. And joining us here by telephone for the second straight week is Catherine Kirsten. Catherine is a writer and attorney, a senior policy fellow, and founding director at the Center of the American Experiment, having also served as its chair from 1996 to 98. Catherine has also served as a Metro columnist for the Star Tribune from 2005 to 2008, and before that was an opinion columnist for the paper for 17 years. Catherine, once again, it's an honor to have you join us tonight on Education Nation.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we had a wonderful time talking about the 1619 Project last week, and now we're on to another very important topic that really affects education right here in Minnesota directly. Minnesota schools, along with schools from across the nation, have grown frustrated with the decades-long failures in trying to shrink the stubborn racial learning gap. Who are the main persons behind the Page-Cascari constitutional amendment, and is this amendment any different from past efforts to shrink the racial learning gap?
Well, the main people are the people who've given their names to the amendment. Former Chief Justice Alan Page of the Minnesota Supreme Court, and Neil Kashkari, who's president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank. This amendment is well, there have been all kinds of attempts to shrink materially the racial learning gap, which exists in every state in the union. This one, I would say, is essentially unique in that it proposes to amend our state constitution and create, for the first time, a positive right that is a right that doesn't just bar the government from taking certain kinds of actions like, you know, inhibiting freedom of speech, but a positive right. It requires the state to guarantee that all children will be, quote, fully prepared with the skills necessary to participate in the economy, our democracy, and society. Mm-hmm. So it makes the state a guarantor. Now, this, as I've written, is like a constitutional amendment that guarantees every child a constitutional right to be a successful high school athlete.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how to do this. The gap has been closed essentially nowhere. And now it's going to be, the state is going to guarantee without any description of how that is supposed to happen. I mean, it's wishful thinking. It's understandable. You know, there's a noble aspiration.
Yes,
here,
I was going to say that.
Very, mm-hmm. very naive.
Right. Yes. In fact, some of the language that it uses is it claims to give all children, you know, all children, a fundamental right, which sounds wonderful, to a quality public education, which sounds wonderful, that fully prepares them, which sounds wonderful, for participation in the economy, our democracy, and society. Now, it's interesting, you know, we talked about this before we went on air, that this doesn't necessarily guarantee a wonderful education that is going to maximize a child's gifts and talents and allow them to be fully human. This seems to me that it's guaranteeing that they get that they have a job of some kind. And not that that's a bad aspiration either, but this isn't about education, it seems. But from the perspective of those in favor of the amendments itself, what are the intentions behind the amendments' phrases? What are they really hoping for? Are they really hoping to close the achievement gap, or do they have some different ideas in mind?
Right. Clearly the only reason to propose a constitutional amendment is that you want to give the courts control over education policy and funding in Minnesota. If you didn't, then why would you not just approach reform through the normal channels of going to the legislature or going to your local school board?
Mm-hmm.
You can do that without a constitutional amendment. Constitutional amendment is put there because it's clearly anticipated that the courts going forward will be the primary arbiters of what we do with education here in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
This has not worked out well in other states.
Mm, I mean, essentially, they'd be replacing the legislative branch
yeah.
of the state.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, removing Democratic control, putting it in the hands of, our Supreme Court justices here in Minnesota, where mm-hmm. one justice's vote can make the difference in terms of what we spend on our schools, the kinds of tax hikes that we experience. I mean, it goes mm-hmm. on and on. This is not a democratic approach to education reform.
Right.
Yeah. And you've written too, Catherine, that the amendment is virtually certain not to produce the desired academic improvements. In fact, it would potentially create several avenues of mischief. What are some of the main troubling consequences that would come as a result of this amendment if it should be adopted?
Well, one thing is that it makes K-12 funding the paramount duty of the state of Minnesota. That means, from a legal point of view, that K-12 funding must always now get first dollar in state spending, and unless you have an infinite budget and revenue that never ends, this is going to crowd out vital priorities like higher education, public safety, health care, that kind of thing, and certainly has done that to one extent or another in other states.
Yeah.
But I think one of the most troubling things is that you hand over control to courts and you expect something, right? Some kind of achievement gains that are significant and lasting from this. There isn't a state in the country where this has happened. In fact, in New Jersey, in Washington State, in a host, I believe in Wyoming, there's a host of states, you see some of the largest tax increases in the history of those states to cover this increased educational mm-hmm. spending without seeing academic improvement mm-hmm. On the part of low-income mm-hmm. and minority mm-hmm. students.
Which is, that's been the history. You pour more and more money in, but it's not, that's not really what is needed.
And just to give I'm sorry, go ahead, Catherine.
Well, just that you crowd out alternative reforms, which
right.
we can talk about.
That's what I was just saying. Yeah.
That actually are likely to have some success. That's not what courts do. Courts don't look at pedagogy, you know, how kids
right.
are taught to read. They don't require greater accountability in schools' use of money and that kind of thing. All they know how to do really is to hand out more money, and that's what they do in states where this happens.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking big money here, and just to kind of give our listeners a picture of this, I believe in New Jersey today, I mean, isn't the average student, there's, what, $34,000 allocated to each student in the state of New Jersey, roughly?
Well, this is not per student. This is in the so-called Abbott school districts. This litigation of the kind we are contemplating here now was first filed in New Jersey in 1970.
Oh, wow.
And, it continues to go on. I think they're called the Abbott school district. They're low-performing school districts with high proportions of low-income minority students. They take up a huge percentage of the, I think they're like 34 or something of them, but they take up a huge percentage of education spending in New Jersey. And it's there, I'm sorry, that students may receive as much as $34,000 per year in terms of state funding.
Wow.
But academic improvement has not significantly occurred. And in some of these Abbott districts, performance has fallen.
Wow. Hmm. Oh, my goodness.
And that's, 50 years.
Unbelievable. Wouldn't this be
on the horizon, I think it's called Abbott 24 or something.
And they're going to try to put more towards it?
Yep.
Oh, my goodness. Hmm. Yeah, that's really... I wish that the people here would take a look at, well, and that's what you're trying to call out for them, and I'm glad that you're doing that, helping them see what other states have done and what what the results have been for them. So, so Catherine, you write that some claim that Page and Kashgari Amendment would boost academic achievement in Minnesota. What requirements do proponents cite that lead them to believe the amendment would be successful?
Well, they say that we can expect student performance to go up because the Constitution will now say that student performance has to be measured against, quote, uniform achievement standards. Mm-hmm. Well, the history of Minnesota education reform pretty clearly demonstrates, as you point out with your statistics on graduation rates,
right,
that we can't set standards that some kids fail to meet and continue to keep those standards at a high or, frankly, even a mediocre level. Mm-hmm. And so there's this inexorable political pressure to lower the standards.
Yep.
So in the name of, quote, equity, we can say that essentially everybody is achieving those standards.
Mm-hmm. And then that harkens back to what I was saying earlier, where the language actually uses the term economic... what does it say?
Democracy and society.
Yeah, economic and democracy and society. And so they aren't, I think that, like you said, that they really would just lower the standard then. And, well, if we can just get this person a job and they can be out the door. And I find that really troubling.
It's like a double-edged sword, too, in the sense, these businesses, these leaders are pushing to want to get people out the door to have jobs. But what happens when they come interviewing and they're not ready for the jobs?
Exactly.
Now
That's
they
such
have
a
to
good
do the educating
point, Mark.
On
such
the back
point.
End when they're
yes.
actually there in the doors interviewing.
That is such a good point.
And that is the very reason cited by business groups that support this amendment, such as the State Chamber of Commerce and the Minnesota Business Partnership. They are very frustrated that so many kids are coming to them unprepared for the world of work. But, you pass a constitutional amendment like this, mm-hmm. and it's going to greatly increase the likelihood of a massively expensive lawsuit where, the claim will be, hey, you said all kids have to be fully prepared for the economic activity. These kids are not. Therefore, we need even more money in an effort to prepare them for these jobs that they are simply not skilled enough to perform well today,
Right, and as you said that because it does lower the standards, these businessmen that are supporting this amendment, again, they've got good idea, they've got good motivations, but because they are not educators themselves, they don't necessarily understand what is the best way to improve the educational outcome of students. And I've said many times on this show, there are a lot of charter schools and private schools and even some public schools that are actually doing really, really well with minority students, and Hope Academy downtown Minneapolis being one of them, Ascension in Minneapolis being another, and Crystal Ray. And so we know how to close the achievement gap. The problem is that the public schools don't want to implement those methods that actually work.
Precisely. Education Minnesota, there are entrenched special interests that are happy with the status quo, and that's the primary reason we have not been able to achieve significant education reform in this state.
Right. And we did talk as a result of the declining student performance amongst all people groups, the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments, but yet graduation rates were going up. We invite our listeners again to listen to this show on our podcast at ednationmn.org, episode number 155. It's titled 2018 Minnesota Graduation Rates and Achievement Gaps. For a more detailed description of the breakdown that has steadily occurred over the last decade. Mm-hmm. Well, you were listening to Education Nation here on AM 1280 The Patriot. Our guest again is Catherine Kirsten, who is here. She's the Senior Policy Fellow and Founding Director at the Center of the American Experiment. And we're here discussing this Paige Kashkari constitutional amendment proposal that could shift the power of legislative input from the legislative branch, as it was designed and intended to, over to the judicial branch.
Mm-hmm, for education.
Absolutely.
Say, Catherine, one of the things that I noticed is that you have some conservative lawmakers that are really in favor of this amendment, McFadden being one of them. Can you respond to that? I read his counter argument to your article, and I didn't think that he answered the questions that you raise in your article.
Right, McFadden, who has ran for Senate as a Republican a number of years ago, correct?
Yes. And he's a business leader, I know. And and so I'm sure that he's been able to garner a lot of support for that through the business community. So it's important that he understand the reality around this. And so I would love to have you take a moment to respond to some of the concerns that he raised.
Right. Well, he clearly is not clear on how courts work. He's not clear on the threat of a lawsuit or mini lawsuit that is created or enhanced by this amendment. I think these business leaders, in many cases, as you point out, Rebecca, they don't understand how kids, let's say, learn to read.
Right.
And it's as if there's some kind of magic that happens when you put, 40 new words in the Constitution. if we could go back and look carefully at what the kinds of reforms that were attempted in the era of Governor Tim Pawlenty, when there was actually real momentum around the country for meaningful education reform, No Child Left Behind and that kind of thing, they would be so much better informed if they understood that the massive effort that was made there, scientifically based reading instruction, for example, intense focus on working with phonics for early literacy and that kind of thing, real focus on school accountability, on incentivizing teachers to teach in a way that raises kids' achievements. If they could see how a lot of that was considered and some of it even passed, and then how it was shot down in so many instances after Governor Dayton became governor. Mm-hmm. They would understand, I think, much better what it takes. What real education reform takes is a very committed governor who understands what needs to change in the way that we teach and run our schools, a legislature that supports it, and then the courage to stand up against these special entrenched interests that work against those reforms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So well said. And I hope we get some business leaders that are taking a serious look at your concerns. So, all right.
Well, how is the state doing with basic skills tests for teachers? And are they a part of Governor Walz's education agenda for 2020? Maybe a rhetorical question.
Interesting that you raised that question. Yes, this was something that, again, was a focus back in the Pawlenty era, attempting to raise teacher skills and to encourage more expertise on the part of their of teachers as they prepare to teach their core subjects. There were attempts to raise the scores that teachers need to get on basic skills tests in order to be licensed. Well, we've seen a steady erosion there. And for 2020, Governor Walz is now proposing to eliminate basic skills tests for teachers entirely. Now, we know that having a good teacher is one of the most important factors in academic success for youngsters. Mm-hmm. And here we are, you know, with a governor who is proposing to eliminate those basic skills tests or a passage of those tests entirely as a condition of licensure.
Which I think is also interesting because accountability is what they're trying to find here. And if you're not going to hold the teachers accountable, then again, it harkens back to what kind of quality do they really mean when they talk about a quality education for all children?
Yep. And just an observation, too. I mean, in the past two legislative sessions, there have been opportunities for opportunity scholarship tax credits that businesses wanted to put money
mm-hmm.
towards.
Yes.
And because the legislative mm-hmm. branch in the mm-hmm. Minnesota legislature didn't step up to the plate, and of course they were blocked by a governor that wasn't going to sign it anyway, but because that didn't happen then, now they're just back to throwing money at the problem, and now we're looking at more lack of local control as a result, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Precisely, yes. And of course, well, that flexibility and autonomy on the part of schools is held up as very important by Paige and Kashkari in terms of reform that actually improves, has a good chance of improving kids' achievement. But by proposing, by setting things up so that the courts would take power essentially over our educational policy, they undercut the very thing that they themselves acknowledge is important.
Mm.
I mean, in their reports, in the Fed reports that support this amendment, they point to charter schools as evidence of the kind of reform that we need. But, of course, when a court takes control, rigidity destroys mm-hmm. or undermines school autonomy in ways that are so destructive to teaching young people.
Right. And you pointed out, too, at the top of the show, actually, before we went on air, that you've had some conversations with people down in Florida where this constitutional amendment, or maybe is it in Florida as well or just New Jersey that you were mentioning?
So the Fed in its reports points to Florida, which mm-hmm. did have a constitutional amendment back in 1998 as really the leading example that Minnesota should follow. The Fed doesn't tell you that constitutional amendment had nothing to do with the academic reforms that were successful with low-income minority students there. What did make a massive difference, in fact, mm-hmm. all the difference, was a very careful, comprehensive education reform agenda put in place by Governor Jeb Bush
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
And a legislature, over an eight-year period, Bush apparently spent 4 years from 1994 to 1998 visiting something like 250 schools and putting his reform agenda in place. That reform agenda isn't even mentioned by the Fed, much less it's not held up as the reason that Florida has had the kind of success it has.
Interesting. That is very interesting. Well, there is some good news in this country, a model that is emerging that is showing just how to raise academic achievement. You write about this happening in Mississippi. Can you explain for our listeners how the state of Mississippi is leading the way on raising academic achievement?
Sure. And the state of Mississippi took a page from Florida. So the reforms underway in Mississippi were first adopted in Florida. And what you see surprising results in Mississippi, which we all think of as, you know, essentially at the very bottom in terms of student achievement.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Last year, Mississippi ranked number one in the nation for gains in fourth grade reading and math on the mm-hmm. National Assessment of Educational Progress. And it spends much less per pupil, you can imagine, than mm-hmm. Minnesota. And listen to this, 75% of Mississippi students are eligible for free or reduced lunch.
Oh, my goodness.
37%
then that's incredible.
Scholars.
Yeah.
But today, its low-income students are third in the nation on fourth-grade reading, and Minnesota's are 40th.
Wow.
It's all about how you teach. So they are using an intense focus on early literacy, where they, as a last resort, they retain third graders who still cannot read at the end of third grade for an additional year of enriched, highly individualized instruction, not just the same thing they did before, but using data, using a strong phonics background to enable kids to get over that critical third grade reading hump. And you can see that it's bearing fruit.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's great news.
Yep. And instead of producing the academic gains, Catherine, what do you see as the fallout that would accompany a Paige Kashkari constitutional amendment?
Well, clearly it would open up Pandora's box of lawsuits. I mean, just think of it. By the way, we already have such a lawsuit underway here in Minnesota. It's the Cruz-Guzman lawsuit, which is currently in mediation. And Keith Ellison, who is supposed to be defending the state against this, has actually enthusiastically called for the passage of the Kashkari, Paige Kashkari amendment, saying how much easier it would make a victory for plaintiffs in a suit of this kind. So, hardly defending as he should. But at any rate, there are all kinds of ways that plaintiffs would almost certainly launch lawsuits to try to compel their own vision of quality education. Now, you mentioned, Rebecca, that this new amendment includes the words, all children have a right. All children, not kids 5 through 18, which I believe is what's currently contemplated in the law having to do with our state education system. All children means from birth. It is my understanding that there are legislators who are very much in favor of universal preschool education for kids almost from birth. And this kind of thing would be facilitated and could conceivably even be compelled under an amendment like this. But there are all kinds of other dangers. For example, the fact that children now have... Yes.
Sorry to cut you down here or cut you off here, but we literally have about 40 seconds. So if you can just quickly finish your sentence and then we'll exit out. Thank you.
Oh, yes. Okay. A great danger to homeschool and private school students who might be forced to return to public school because they're not getting a quality education defined as, say, comprehensive sex ed.
Yes. Yes. Or LGBTQ and all of that. So that is such an important point. I hope our listeners go back and listen to this podcast again so that they can get all the details on ednationmn.org, ednationmn.org. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you, Mark and Catherine.
See you later.
We'll see you next week.